Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. For many, there has to be a sense of, here we go again. After returning to something close to normal for the first time in over a year this summer, COVID-19 infections are on the rise again throughout the country, including here in Pennsylvania. The combination of the Delta variant of the virus, which is much more contagious, and a still large percentage of people who aren't vaccinated, has led to the surge. Yesterday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention updated their guidelines and now recommend that everyone in school, K through 12, wear masks. That includes students, teachers, and staff. Here in Pennsylvania, Governor Tom Wolf said the state is not requiring masks in schools. The CDC also recommended mask wearing indoors in high areas of transmission. So what's it all mean? What questions do you still have about the variant, about the virus? Joining us is Dr. John Goldman, an infectious disease specialist at UPMC. Dr. Goldman, good to have you back on the program. Did you see this surge coming?
I saw what I thought was going to be a increase in cases in the summer in the South, where there are very few vaccinations. If you recall, the last summer, we had a surge in the South. I think it has a lot to do with people heading indoors because of air conditioning, because it's hot, because of air conditioning. And then if you look at the South in particular, there are very low rates of vaccination, usually about 50% of the population. In contrast, and I think we need to put this in perspective, we are having a quote-unquote surge in Pennsylvania. But if you look at Florida, their cases are going up very quickly from around 1,000 cases a day to around 10,000 cases a day. In contrast, if you look at Pennsylvania, our cases are going up, but they're going up much more slowly, and they're going up at much more levels. So our lowest number, we had about 150 cases a day. We're now up to about 500. So they've tripled, but we actually, at our quote-unquote surge, are less than the fewest cases in Florida. Also, you have to remember that this is a surge among the unvaccinated. It is rare. People clearly do get breakthrough infections with once they're vaccinated, they clearly get breakthrough infections with the Delta variant. But the vast majority of those infections are mild. So if you look at the people in the country who are hospitalized with COVID, so all across the country, 93% or so, well, more than 90%, who are hospitalized with COVID are unvaccinated. 99% of the people who have died of COVID are unvaccinated. So this is a quote-unquote surge, but one, it's a surge among the unvaccinated. And two, in our area, because we've got about two-thirds of the population who are vaccinated, we're having an increase, but both the rise is much slower and the number of cases is much lower.
You know, I hesitated to even use the word surge in relationship to Pennsylvania because, as you just explained, Pennsylvania has far fewer cases per day than some of those southern states like Florida, Louisiana, Missouri, not a southern state, but an area where there are many unvaccinated people, and there is a real surge going on. I think here in Pennsylvania, the latest figure is that over 63% of the population has been fully vaccinated. But before we go on to talking about the vaccinations, let's talk a little bit about the Delta variant. What can you tell us about the Delta variant and how it's different than the original virus that came to the United States?
So the Delta variant is more infectious than the original virus. It's more infectious than the Alpha variant, which caused our increase in cases over the spring. So the typical original COVID variant, in the absence of social distancing, infected 2 to 3 people. The Alpha variant is 50% more infectious than the original variant, and the Delta variant is 50% more infectious than the Alpha variant. So instead of infecting 2 to 3 people, it infects 4 to 6. In contrast, the flu, which we often compare the coronavirus, that we compare COVID to, infects 1 to 2 people. So the Delta variant has allowed the virus to spread itself much more easily. There's some data, and it's not good data, that we have that it may cause more severe disease. That data isn't really good. It probably makes you a little bit more sick, but it probably isn't night and day different. There are the average patient in our hospital is clearly younger, but that's because even in areas like Florida, where there's not a lot of vaccination, more than 90% of the population, which is at highest risk, the population above the age of 65 has been vaccinated. In Pennsylvania, I think it's well over 95%. The Delta variant does... Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish what you're going to say.
The Delta variant does. So if you get asymptomatic infection and you're vaccinated, you clearly spew out more virus if you're infected with the Delta variant. That should not be interpreted as you spew out the same amount as if you're unvaccinated. With basically all viral illnesses, if you have a breakthrough infection when you're vaccinated, not only are you less likely to get severely ill, you are less likely to, the amount of virus you cough out into the air is much less. The issue is that because the virus is more infectious, because even if you're vaccinated, you cough out a fair amount of virus, they are urging people to be more cautious. So the one thing that's been is, you know, and the way I tell people is if you are at higher risk, so for example, you're older, you have more medical conditions, I would have a much lower threshold for mask wearing. If you're in a high transmission area, like Florida, like Texas, like most of the South, I would be much more cautious. The good news is we are actually seeing very relatively few cases in Pennsylvania, and I believe that that is because we have vaccinated a good portion of our population.
If you have a question or a comment, this is an opportunity for you to ask that question of Dr. John Goldman, an infectious disease specialist at UPMC. I mean, even a year and a half into this, there still are questions. As you can tell, there still are many changes in the variants, the recommendations from the CDC. Just a lot has changed even from February of 2020. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Before we start taking questions from our audience, Dr. Goldman, one of the things I think is always worth repeating and stressing is this question about whether the vaccines are effective against the Delta variant. Are they?
Absolutely. So we have to define effectiveness two ways. One is preventing any disease, and you read anywhere between as low as 60%, but typically in the 80 to 90% range. And when we say effective, what that means is effective at preventing you from having any infection, including mild infections. The vast majority of people that I have seen who have been infected after vaccination have minimal to no symptoms. The vaccines are effective against preventing severe disease at hospitalizations at a greater than 95% rate. So if you have been vaccinated, the chances that you will end up getting severe disease, hospitalizing, or dying are less than 5%. In addition, those people who do have breakthrough infections tend to be older, UPMC has done a pretty nice study where they show people who are immune suppressed have a lower response to the vaccine. So the people who tend to fail the vaccine tend to be older, tend to have something that it suppresses their immune system. But even if they get disease, that tends to be much more mild, and it is very unlikely that they will end up in the hospital, end up in the intensive care unit, or die.
I have a question here from Amy. It says, I have a friend who had COVID in May. She's been avoiding getting the vaccine because she figures she has antibodies, but being infected and is naturally protected. Could she get infected by the Delta variant, and how can I convince her to go and get vaccinated?
Well, first of all, I think one of the really good questions is how long does natural immunity last? And in other coronaviruses, natural immunity tends to fade out over a period of months. The issue is this disease hasn't been on this earth long enough for us to know whether or not you can really get reinfected. What I typically advise people is if they've been infected with coronavirus, after about 12 weeks, to get the full vaccine series. The little bit of data we have, and we don't have good data, is that the people who have had coronavirus get the vaccine actually get a very strong immune response. And so they are likely to have the longest immune response. They're likely not to get infected with the Delta variant. So it is a bit of a judgment call, but my recommendation is that they would get vaccination because they're likely to have a pretty strong immune response, and they're likely to be one of the people who's most protected.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Joining us today is Dr. John Goldman, an infectious disease specialist at UPMC, answering your coronavirus questions. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Faith in Lancaster. Faith, you're on Smart Talk.
Good morning. Thank you. I have to have surgery later this month, and I'm fully vaccinated, but I have to have a COVID test 3 days before. And I have heard that the tests are not sensitive enough to determine the level of antibodies in your system. And I'm afraid that if I have any level of antibody, even if I'm not infectious, that I will be disqualified. Could you have the doctor address that? And I'll hang up.
All right. Thank you, Faith. Dr. Goldman, what about that?
The test is a PCR test, which detects the DNA from the virus. It does not detect antibodies. So there are absolutely no worries that if you're vaccinated, especially if you're vaccinated remotely, that you will have a positive PCR test before your surgery without being infected. The PCR test detects the antibodies, detects the virus, not the antibodies to that virus. So getting vaccinated does not produce a positive test. You do not have to worry about your surgery being delayed.
We have a question from David in Edders. He wants to know the latest word on choral groups. Is it okay to sing groups? Performance season's coming up this fall. Curious on the guidance on singing in groups with other people and performing for a crowd. That's a kind of a narrow question, but a good one if you're doing it.
Well, it's a very good question, because when you sing, it's a higher rate of transmission. So you have to distinguish two things. One, the risk from the singers to the audience, which is higher because they're singing. There's a whole bunch of studies that people in choruses are more infectious because of the singing. And then there's also the question of the risk to the singers from a crowd, especially an indoor crowd. A couple recommendations. First of all, I would think that it's extremely important that everyone in the choral group is vaccinated, because the chances that they will get infected are much lower than if they aren't vaccinated. We talked a little earlier, if they do have asymptomatic infection, they are likely to send out more virus. You aren't going to get around that risk. I would also recommend the choral group, either the performance either be outdoors, which is much less risk, or if it's indoors, I would strongly recommend that the audience wear a mask. I would strongly recommend that the audience be vaccinated. You're not going to check vaccination cards at the door. So singing is a higher risk activity because you send more virus out into the air. I would recommend that you make sure all of the choral group is vaccinated. And if it's an indoor performance, I would recommend that the audience be masked.
Jen has a question, wants to know, as an elementary school teacher and a parent, I am very concerned with school districts that are making masks completely voluntary. Why not mask up when the elementary school population isn't even eligible for a vaccine yet? And I'll just add to that, as I mentioned in the introduction, the CDC yesterday recommended K-12 students, teachers, adults, staff, everyone mask up. But Governor Wolf said that he's not requiring it here in Pennsylvania. The point that Jen makes, Dr. Goldman, about kids and the kind of the unknown.
Yeah, so there are a couple of things. First of all, we have to distinguish public health and politics. If you were going to make a pure public health recommendation, you would obviously have all the kids masked. I'm also aware of the difficulty in getting a six-year-old to mask, getting an elementary school kid to mask. So there are two aspects. One is that the elementary school kids themselves are at much lower risk. There are kids who die of COVID. I think there have been about 400 across the country. There have been more deaths from COVID among children than there have been typically among the flu. But it's still lower risk to the children. The higher risk is that the kids are going to drive the infection and send it home to their parents, worse, their elderly grandparents, and also their teachers. I think it's extremely important for all teachers to be vaccinated. I think that it's important for the teachers' families to be vaccinated so that if they get an infection, they don't bring it home to them. And if it were done on a purely public health perspective, we would probably have all the kids be masked. It's difficult to get grade school kids to mask. And to my amazement, masking has become a political, not a public health issue.
Do you still wear a mask?
I do, depending on the situation. So I will typically wear it if I'm in a crowd. I always wear it if I'm in the hospital, but that's because in the hospital, the stakes are higher. So I'm vaccinated. I've had completed the series in January. Incidentally, I had no side effects other than a mildly sore arm. And in the hospital, I religiously wear my mask because I do not want to take an chance on infecting a patient. And having something bad happen. We take care of a very sick, very vulnerable population, and I frankly don't want that on my conscience.
Yesterday,
when I go out, I will wear a mask if I'm in a crowd, and I won't put myself in a large crowd right now.
Yesterday, another of the recommendations from the CDC was for people to wear a mask in high areas of transmission. Well, you know, that's hard for a lot of people to determine themselves what is a high area of transmission. Now, in some states that we've mentioned, Florida, Missouri, Louisiana, states like that where we know there's a high area of transmission. But what about here in Pennsylvania? I mean, how is someone to know what is a high area of transmission? And I should say that is the recommendation was to wear a mask indoors in high areas of transmission. It created some confusion.
So it did create some confusion. But part of the issue is that, first of all, Pennsylvania is, in general, a low transmission state. Second of all, you can actually go to the CDC website. You can look on their homepage, and you can break it down by all the way down to the amount of transmission in a county. And you can just look. It's either red, orange, or yellow. If you look on Pennsylvania, we actually, with one county, which is high, everything else is moderate or low. And so if you really want to look up the county you live in, you can simply go to the CDC website and look it up on a map. As a general rule, there are very few parts of Pennsylvania that have high levels of transmission right now. And again, I think it's 65% of the population has gotten at least one dose of the vaccine, and that's because we have a lot of vaccination.
I want to tell a story of a friend on Facebook told this story, and it's kind of a follow-up to what you said about you think the teachers should be vaccinated. I want to talk about healthcare workers. This friend called his doctor's office, I think it was a routine checkup, and asked if staff was vaccinated and was told yes, showed up. The person, I don't know if it's a nurse or what, but the staff member who was attending to him, he asked her, "Are you vaccinated?" And this person responded, "That's none of your, well, nah, in so many words, it's none of your business, HIPAA, privacy," and wouldn't answer the question. So the friend decided, okay, I'm going home. If you're not going to tell me you're vaccinated, that I'm not going to allow you to be near me. Brings up the point about the healthcare workers. I mean, there still are, I won't say a large percentage, but a percentage of healthcare workers who aren't vaccinated, don't plan to get vaccinated. There are some providers out there that are requiring it, but the friend and the tact he took, is that the way to go?
You know, there are a couple of things. First of all, as someone asking a non-physician, HIPAA actually doesn't apply to non-healthcare workers. There is no HIPAA prohibition from you asking anyone whether or not they're vaccinated. On the other hand, people may or may not consider it your business, and there's no mandate that a healthcare worker or anyone else answers truthfully. I personally think that it is an obligation of all healthcare workers to get vaccinated, because if you do not, you're putting your patients at risk. I personally believe that it's an obligation of all healthcare workers to get the flu shot for the exact same reason. Personally, I do not want to accidentally give either the flu or COVID to a vulnerable patient who may have something really bad happen, may even die. There's been a lot of talk about mandatory vaccinations. And again, if this were purely a public health issue, I think that we've done mandatory vaccinations with other illnesses, the flu, for example. On the other hand, the vaccine has not been out for a long time. It's still under an emergency use authorization. And I believe that it's extremely safe. I believe that it is much safer than getting COVID. 1 out of 500 Americans has died from COVID. The most common serious non-fatal reactions from the vaccine occur in the 1 out of 100,000 to 1 out of 1 million range. So your risk of dying from COVID is 200 to 2,000 times the most common non-fatal serious reactions to the vaccine. The problem is that there are a lot of people who feel strongly against the vaccine. I believe completely illogically. When I've had people show me their reasoning, it's not that hard to poke holes in it. But I think that if you're a healthcare worker, you should get vaccinated. I believe if you're a healthcare worker, you have an obligation not to harm your patients. But not everybody agrees with me.
We have a question from Melinda, wants to know, first, I've been hearing rumblings of a Lambda variant. Is this something that we should be concerned about?
You know, the virus mutates rapidly. One of the ways I've heard it put is that the unvaccinated are, in fact, variant factories. And there is a Lambda variant. It is not the predominant variant in the United States. The biggest issue that I would have would be that a variant, not the Delta variant, but a future variant would have a decreased efficacy or evade the vaccine. And that has fortunately not happened. The problem is that the more infection we have, the more the virus has a chance to mutate, the more it has, and the natural selection will pick out the most infectious viruses. Now, fortunately, we have not had any that have occurred that have evaded the vaccine. But I don't think the worry is as much about the variants that are currently out there that may be more infectious, but the vaccine seemed to work against, than a future variant that may evade the vaccine. That would be much more serious.
Melinda had a second question. Wanted to know, at what point do you think a vaccine will be available for children under 12?
So the FDA is currently studying that. I would guess by December, but as I like to put it, I left my crystal ball at home today.
This is a question off Twitter. Pfizer has released new data that suggests a third dose of its COVID-19 vaccine strongly boosts protection against the Delta variant. They're posting more information on this later today. The point that the listener brings up, though, begs the question, will we need booster shots?
So I personally believe that we will, for two reasons. One, that natural immunity to COVID virus fades out. So I would think at some point that the immunity to this virus will fade. That is more speculation. The virus, the immunity has held. So, you know, we started giving people vaccine in December. People who are vaccinated in December are not. There's no evidence that immunity is fading out. The other issue is, like the flu virus, this virus mutates fairly rapidly. So it has a chance to mutate. The flu virus, we need a flu shot every year because there's slight changes in the virus that make last year's flu vaccine less effective. And so I think that we are going to need some kind of booster. I suspect that the first people will get it will be the most vulnerable, those who are older and those who are immune suppressed. I will tell, and so far the FDA has said that is not indicated. I will tell you that if I've had two shots of the vaccine, I've had two shots of Pfizer. If I was offered a booster, I would take it because of the Delta variant, because I believe that the benefits outweigh the harms.
I have a question from Dana in South Renovo, which is in Clinton County. She says, we are having major natural gas work being done in this area in Clinton County. This means there are a lot of out-of-staters, Oklahoma, for example. Do they pose a threat to the community that could create a hotspot? Locals are being careful, but people from out of town are not.
The issue is that if you look on the map of the United States, the Northeast has very little COVID. And it really depends on where they're coming from. A good portion of the South, of Texas, of some of the West has higher levels. So they're coming from an area where they are more likely to have COVID and less likely to be vaccinated than they are of higher risk. There's no way that I could tell if an individual, where an individual worker is from, or whether or not the individual worker has been vaccinated. So I couldn't apply that to an individual. But as a general rule, if they're coming from a high-risk area and if they're coming from an area where there are lower rates of vaccination, they are more likely to spread the disease. I don't know how you tell that with an individual person.
John says, I'm a home health occupational therapy assistant for the South Central Pennsylvania and Western Maryland regions. I have observed with clients through work, coworkers at my job, family, and friends, that misinformation is a leading cause to not getting vaccinated. Subjects still coming up are infertility caused by the vaccine, still wanting to do their own research, or receiving outright false information, such as vaccinated people are actually the ones being hospitalized at a higher rate. What more can be said to sway people toward getting vaccinated?
You know, they've actually looked at this, and about 20 to 30% of the population has believes in conspiracies, and it's very hard to convince them. What I have found is that the people want to be vaccinated when something strikes close to home. Someone gets sick, someone gets hospitalized, someone dies. You don't wish that on anybody. And for example, the internet rumor that it causes infertility. Well, the Journal of the American Medical Association actually published a study looking at sperm counts in men before and after vaccination. And unsurprisingly, it didn't change. There's an internet rumor that it affects the placenta. You know, the vaccine produces the same antibody as the virus. There are no reports of infertility with either the vaccine or the virus. But many people believe what they see on Facebook over good science. And in fact, the vaccinated people are the ones getting hospitalized is patently untrue. More than 90% of the people in this country are hospitalized with COVID are unvaccinated. 99% of the people who die from COVID are vaccinated. And I'll just tell you personally, the people that we have in the hospital right now are universally unvaccinated. And you see people that are really sick, people that are at risk of dying. And it's tragic because this is a preventable disease. And you see people that are often high risk that watched social media and decided not to get a vaccine because of the 1 in a million chance that they may get Guillain-Barré because of the rumor they got infertility. And now they're on a ventilator. And you know that once they get on a ventilator, their chances of getting off are only 1 out of 3. It's tragic. It's painful to watch. And what I find most disturbing is there's an entire ecosystem of people lying, making up stuff like infertility, making up stuff like the vaccines are responsible, the people being hospitalized by who are vaccinated. when people have sent me this kind of stuff, it takes a little while to deconstruct. It takes a little while to realize, okay, why is this wrong? And I just think it's tragic that we have an entire ecosystem of media, of social media, that is basically lying to people and telling them that the vaccines are riskier than COVID after we've had 600,000 Americans die.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, Pennsylvania U.S. Senator Bob Casey will be discussing a number of issues with Senator Casey. Also on the program, Philip Rucker, who is co-author of I Alone Can Fix It, new book, I Alone Can Fix It, Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Year in Office, and interesting book. Philip Rucker, Washington Post, Washington correspondent, will be on the program as well. That's coming up on tomorrow's show. Dr. John Goldman, infectious disease specialist at UPMC, is our guest today, answering your COVID questions. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Let's take a phone call from Bill in Lingolstown. Bill, you're on Smart Talk.
Good morning, Scott, and thank you for taking my call. I agree with the good doctor. This is tragic, and I think that the only way we can win these people over is to win them over with information. So how do we find out about information about participating in the booster trials?
You know, the information in booster trials, I frankly don't know, because I don't know, not aware of any going on in this area. And I'm gonna have to apologize and just say I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, let me ask you this question, Dr. Goldman. Typically, how does someone get involved in a trial?
So, for example, for inpatients at UPMC Pinnacle or UPMC Central Pennsylvania, we actually have an ongoing trial the REMAP trial that randomizes people to various treatments. There are a number of treatments available through academic centers, both the NIH, the National Institutes of Health will actually maintain a database of clinical trials going on in your area. It usually for COVID will be either through a hospitalization, through your outpatient physician, or through one of the NIH trials.
Mm-hmm. Have a question here from Joyce. It says, I have been fully vaccinated. In the unlikely event that I would get breakthrough COVID, I know it is not likely I would get very ill, but might I end up with long-term complications anyway?
So that's an extremely good question. And I'll have to admit that I have an idea of the answer. I do not have good data. So the long haul COVID patients, the people who have the brain fog, the tiredness, those seem to be with more severe disease. And if you have breakthrough infections, you're likely to have mild disease. What we've seen is that long-haul COVID does not typically occur in breakthrough patients, although we don't have a lot of good data yet. Some of the more feared complications, for example, a blood clot, a stroke, a pulmonary embolism, a blood clot going to the lung, are clearly less common with breakthrough infections.
I think we have a question related to those long-term or long-haul cases. Bob is in Lancaster. Bob, you're on Smart Talk.
Hi, my question has to do with a friend who has had COVID. She has now a situation where she's difficulty walking. What are the long-term effects of having COVID? The long-term effects.
Okay, thank you, Bob.
So So there are a couple of different, and so you have to know why she has difficulty walking. So one of the things that COVID does is it makes your blood clot more easily. And so one of the presentations of COVID is young, otherwise healthy people who present with a stroke, who present with a blood clot in their leg, who present with a pulmonary embolism. And so if she had a stroke, it would be because of the stroke. So she'd be, the other issue is a lot of people have the brain fog. A lot of people have weakness. The weakness can lead to a difficulty walking. And why they have that isn't well defined. We've had some people, for example, nursing home residents who just stop feeling like eating. And so they have COVID, they survive the COVID, and they kind of waste away. And we don't really understand why all this happens yet. There are a lot of other viral illnesses that produce similar symptoms. But what typically happens, if it's not from something like a stroke, is over a period of months, it gradually gets better. Most people will recover. They usually recover much more slowly than they would.
Martin wants to know, what is the importance of sanitizing surfaces? Should we be concerned about groceries and delivered items? This is something that a lot of people have. I mean, we've kind of gotten in the habit of doing it, but now that we are seeing more cases, what about sanitizing surfaces?
So I think it is always a good idea to wash your hands. However, the vast majority of COVID is transmitted by the respiratory route, person to person, through you sneeze, you get the virus in the air, someone brings it in. The flu, in contrast, often you cough on a surface, you touch that surface, and people then touch their face. Most of us touch our face 10, 15 times an hour. It seems as if that is a much less common way to transmit COVID. Personally, I do not worry about the groceries. I do not worry about the mail. And I think putting your time and effort into wearing masks and washing your hands is very effective at preventing COVID. So I don't go extra steps for the groceries, the mail. Never a bad idea to wash your hands, never a bad idea to sanitize your surfaces. But I wouldn't take it to an extreme where, you know, you let the grocery sit for a day or the mail sit for a day before you bring it in your house.
Marilyn from Juniata County asks, I'd like to know what the doctor recommends an individual should do if they had a reaction to the vaccine. Should they try another vaccine or a booster?
It depends on what the reaction is. If it's anaphylaxis, where you have a severe allergic reaction, I certainly wouldn't try either of the mRNA vaccines. I might try the Johnson & Johnson. If it is a sore arm, I would just have the other vaccine. Many people with COVID have fevers, chills, sweats. They feel like they have the flu. What I often recommend is people, when they've had that with the first shot, for the second shot, they pre-medicate with Motrin or Tylenol. Many people get rashes at the COVID at the site of the injection. Those won't hurt you. They take longer to go away than you'd like, but you can clearly get the second vaccine. It depends a little bit on how severe the reaction is and what the reaction is. Anaphylaxis, a blood clot, I would definitely not take a second shot. If it's just fevers, chills, sweats, I definitely would.
Bunny says, I'm concerned because COVID numbers are only being reported for the state. I live in Adams County. We are considered a hotspot at this point. Our vaccination rates are low and our numbers are going up. Why are the COVID statistics only being statewide numbers? I think this is misleading to those who live in Adams County who think they are safe. Now, Dr. Goldman, I don't know if you're in a position to tell the state what they should do as far as reporting numbers, but the point she makes, you know, what's happening in Erie County is a little bit different than what may be happening in Dauphin County. So you had mentioned the CDC website. Is this something that maybe individuals should go to that website on a regular basis to find out where their county stands? I know that there are some local media that are reporting. LNP, the Lancaster newspaper, has a count every day for Lancaster County, but not everyone has a daily newspaper. What about that?
So if you actually go to the CDC website and look at the you can look. They will give you a daily trend in the number of COVID cases in the United States, and you can actually get down to a countywide view where you look at the level of transmission, and you look at how many are vaccinated. You can actually do that for your own county. You can get the number of cases and the trend. And I strongly recommend people know what is happening in your area. And you can, for example, look up that about 48% of in Adams County have gotten a dose, 43% are fully vaccinated. And you can see that the moving average is up a little bit in Adams, but it is still actually less than it even was last summer. So you can look up all of this data for your specific county. And the good news for Adams County is they are seeing a little bit of an increase. But, for example, they are still well below the numbers they were last summer.
Ann in Palmyra says, my husband had COVID at Christmas, and his sense of taste is still not back to normal. Is this common?
It is not common, but it occurs. People who have loss of sense of taste or smell frequently have it come back slowly. They actually recommend that you try to exercise it. So I would try having something sweet, something sour, and kind of trying to bring the sense of taste back. There isn't a lot of good data on what works, but it typically comes back within 2, 4, 6 weeks. There are people who it stays, they lose their sense of taste or smell for a longer period of time.
This is probably the last one we'll be able to get on the air. Lisa asked, I recently heard that the PCR test we use to determine positivity rates is not distinguishing between positive presence of active virus versus a positive test resulting from a virus that had been killed by the antibodies of a vaccinated person. I believe it is said that it's to be distinguishable based on virus rates. Is the way we do testing report results pushing up the positivity rates without taking into account this difference? And I have only about a minute left, Doctor.
Okay. The short answer is yes, that's absolutely true. So we've had people remain positive by PCR for months. And when you have someone who previously had COVID, it's hard to distinguish recurrent infection from active infection, from prolonged PCR positivity. I've seen people remain PCR positive for literally 6 months.
Okay, now we have about, I do have about a minute left here. You know, one thing that we have not talked about since the vaccines were introduced last December is testing. If someone has been vaccinated, but they're not feeling well, should they be tested?
I routinely recommend that. A couple of people I found who have had breakthrough infections despite the vaccine often have had only mild symptoms, a little bit of the sniffles. I had one person who we knew his wife was infected. He mentioned he thought he might have mild allergies. We tested him. He was positive. I will point out this was a much older person. I will point out that he never even needed a hospital or any treatment. And I'll also point out that's typically the type of infection that you get if you've been vaccinated.
Should more people be tested?
I recommend testing people when they have symptoms, even when they're vaccinated. And I think it's good to know if you've been infected. The problem is that for vaccinated people, it's very hard to distinguish COVID from any other virus or even mild allergies.
Dr. John Goldman, an infectious disease specialist at UPMC. We always learn a lot when Dr. Goldman is on the program. Dr. Okay. Goldman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.